Good morning, everyone. Way back before I was married, I just started courting my wife, and I had this desire to give her some flowers. Now, I realized that a lot of young men nowadays, the first thing you do when you ask girls, you get some flowers and take a picture. But we didn't do that back then. And so we had just started courting. I thought, is it appropriate to give her flowers already? So I called my sister and asked her if this is all right. And she thought it was. Another young man that goes to our church down there, when he was courting, don't know how long he was courting, he wanted to get flowers for his girlfriend. It was a holiday. And so he called this normal place where he would get flowers for her. And oh, they said, you're too late. They were all booked up. So I think he probably called several different places. Ended up finding a place farther away that, yeah, they could still get flowers, deliver them. But because it was further away, you know, this and that, it cost him a bit more. I think he said maybe said quite a bit more. But he decided, yeah, well, I'm just going to go with it. Now, my question to you is, whether me or the other fella, why were we wanting to give flowers? What was the motivation? Is there some kind of rule that you must give your girlfriend flowers? Or some kind of law that you have to do this? Obviously not. This was a complete different motivation than this is something you must do. This is a motivation that spurred from love. We wanted to do it. Had nothing to do with what we were supposed to do. This is what we wanted to do. Complete different motivation. And wouldn't it be accurate to say that I want to will always go farther, rise higher than I have to? So that's a little bit of my theme here. Any of you who are married or courting, do you want your special one to do nice things for you or whatever because they want to or because, well, I'm supposed to do this, but my heart's not in it? That doesn't sound like a healthy marriage if that's the motivation. Obviously, I want my wife to do what she does because she loves me. She wants to make a much healthier relationship. So what is the greatest commandment? Pretty simple question. I'm going to read it out of Mark 12:30. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. That is the highest of all commands. Now, I want to go back to read something that it said out of the law of Moses that I think gives us a picture of what our relationship with God can be like. It's in Exodus 21, starting at verse 2. Exodus 21, starting in verse 2. If thou buy a Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve thee, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. If he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master have given him a wife, and she have borne him sons or daughters, The wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. And if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out for you, then his master shall bring him unto the judges. He shall also bring him to the door and unto the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. So the first 6 years, he was serving his master because he had to, or he started out that way. After the 6 years were up, he was serving his master because he wanted to. He learned to love his master. He saw that he's well off with his master. His master possibly gave him a wife. Now, think of our relationship with the Lord that way. Am I serving the Lord because I have to or because I want to? We're the Lord's servants. Do I love my master? Now, originally when we come to salvation, maybe what we saw at that point was fear of eternal punishment. We saw we're sinners. We felt like we had to do this, okay? But can't we move on to a greater motivation than just fear of what'll happen if I don't do what God says? Can't we move to a love for the Lord? Appreciation for God and his ways? See the rightness of his ways? Agree in our heart that yes, that is good. Consider these words from Psalms 119. Oh, how I love thy law, but thy law do I love. Therefore I love thy testimonies. Therefore I love thy commandments. Consider how I love thy precepts. Sounds like the author had or was teaching appreciation for the Lord. Are we where we would like to be in delighting in God's will, to do God's will? Or do you see room for improvement? Probably all of us could see room for improvement in us. So how do we love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength? So that we're happy to deny ourselves for his sake, to give of ourselves and serve him, to do things for the Lord. Well, we can just make the mental decision, I'm going to love God. And if you have never surrendered to the Lord, that might be the first step, making the decision. But is growing in our relationship with God only a matter of the will, saying, I am going to do this? Y'all that are married, we're planning to get married. How did your love grow for your spouse? Does anyone want to answer that? How does our love grow in an earthly relationship? Got any courting men here? Young men, I actually happen to know that you have at least one. Yes. By spending time together, learn to appreciate. Anything else? There's more than that. There's something very significant that you do when you're together. What else do you do? Communicate. You talk. You communicate. Those are and there might be other things, but those are the two that I'm tuning into. Spending time together and talking, communicating. So might this work in our relationship with the Lord? If we spend time together, if we talk together? So, what do you talk about? I don't know how you find it. I have a guess that you might find it the same way I find it, is that when something's going wrong in life, it's easier to pray and tell the Lord about it. Okay, we can tell the Lord about our needs, our troubles. One time, this is about 15 years ago, maybe more, maybe less, I'm not sure. Probably not too much more than that. Anyway, I ended up having to take my wife to the emergency room. Ended up with a total of the bills about $7,500. Now, for some of you, that might not be a big deal. For me, I had next to nothing as far as money on hand. It happened during the winter when my work was slow, so I had very little work. And how do you pay the bill? Well, I'm sure we talked to the Lord about it. And the story isn't anything elaborate. There was various aspects of how it all worked out, but every bill got paid on time. So when we go through these experiences with the Lord, that's one thing that can build our love for Him. But there is another principle I would like to present. Let's read a passage out of Luke 8. This is the parable of the sower. I'm just going to read a few verses from that. Three different gospels talk about this parable. Okay, Luke 8, starting at verse 5. A sower went out to sow his seed, and as he sowed, some fell by the wayside, and it was trodden down, and the fowls of the air devoured it. Some fell upon a rock, and as soon as it was sprung up, it withered away, because it lacked moisture. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up with it and choked it. And others fell on good ground and sprang up and bare fruit an hundredfold. And when he had said these things, he cried, "He that hath ears to hear, let him hear." That last phrase, I think he's saying, get this. This is important. Okay. He gave four different examples. What is the thing that he's changed in each example? What is the significant thing of this parable? Can someone answer that? The soil. Yeah, it's just another way of wording it. I was going to say the growing conditions. The growing conditions, the conditions for it to grow in is what changed. Sorry, I got to find where I'm at here. Now, in the parable, he's talking about sowing the word of God. I'm talking about our relationship with God. Is it exactly the same thing? It's in the same camp. So I'm going to use this to apply it to our relationship, our love for the Lord. How can we grow in our love for the Lord? And the one I would like to focus on is the seed that was sown among the thorns. Now, I presume most, if not all of you, are familiar with gardening. You know you can't let the weeds choke out your plants, or you're not going to get much or get anything. So this seed, I will point out, started to grow. Now, okay, obviously we know we're talking about people here. This seed started to grow. In other words, something started in this person. It's not like the seed that was sown on the path where the birds ate it and it never sprouted. So the seed started to grow. In other words, it started a relationship with the Lord. But then something happened that choked it out. So does everyone that starts finish well? The answer is no. If you think about what it says in Jude, he talks about the Lord saved them out of Egypt. Then, how's that worded? Then he destroyed those that believe not, something like that. So there was a start. They all came out of Egypt, but then there's a lot that died in the wilderness because they didn't continue in faith. So there was a start. The seed started to grow, or the relationship with the Lord started. Now, what are these thorns that choke out our love for the Lord? The first one that he, well, actually, if you read the, when he explains it here, better turn to that, over to verse 14. He explains what this is. And that which fell among thorns are they which, when they have heard, and go forth and are choked with cares, riches, and pleasures of this life. So he compares it to three different things. And if you would flip over to Mark, Mark calls it cares, the deceitfulness of riches, and the pleasures of this life. Not pleasures of this life with this one. Lust of other things, I think Mark says. Just to get a kind of a rounded picture of what he's talking about. So cares, riches, and pleasures. Let's take a look at them. What are cares? Can someone give it a little more practical, explain a little bit? What does he mean when he says cares? What are cares of life? Anybody want to give an example? Okay, it can be a yeah? Okay. Any other suggestions? No one hit the one that I want to talk about. What I thought of as cares is worries and things that cause us stress. What can we do about these thorns? Because we're all going to run into this. Can we do something about the things that cause us stress? Well, another thing that I ran into in life, again, back 15 years ago, I don't know how long ago it was, I started making something for my, started selling it to my boss. It was a solid roof, if you want to know what it was. I make them out of stainless steel. I was making these and selling them to my boss. And then, well, there's another fellow that's working with these silos, and he buys from me. And then there was a third fellow, he bought from me one or so. And the problem was, it took me about a whole day to get the thing, the part that I had to do to it. I could cut it out at the, someone with a laser would cut these stainless steel things out, and it took me about a day to get it ready. So I'm working a job, plus I'm trying to do this on the side, and it's getting overwhelming for me. There was probably would have been potential in that business to develop it, but it was overwhelming to me, and so I just threw it away. I said, I'll do it for my boss, and the rest I just didn't sell them to anyone else. That's the way I dealt with it. It was too much for me. Jesus talked about, if you apply it to what Jesus said, if your hand or your foot offend you, this was too much for me, so I cut it off. I threw it away. That's the way I dealt with that stress. Just as an example. So are there things causing you stress that you could cut out, get out of your life? Is it really necessary, this particular thing? Or is the harm that it's doing more than the good that you're getting out of it? an example from the Bible of something that you kind of need to cut out, that's too much. Think about the story of Mary and Martha. It says that Martha was cumbered with much serving. She was probably trying to do an elaborate meal or something. It wasn't simple. She had the extras there. Mary, hey, Jesus is here. I'm going to listen to him. And you know Jesus' response. Mary chose the best part, and he wasn't going to take it away from her. So some stresses in life we can cut out. Sometime it might be a little bit hard. Maybe it's something you think is you just have to have, but ponder that. Is this really worth it? Is what I'm gaining from it worth it? However, some stress you cannot do anything about. It's just circumstances of life. You can't get away from it. In 1 Peter 5, 7, it says, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. It's easy to read that verse. You might have to learn how to do that, though. But that is one way we can deal with the stresses that we can't get rid of. We might have to learn it again and again. An example to put alongside that verse. Think about Peter when he was walking on the water. As long as he kept his eyes on Jesus, he was all right. When he looked at the stress, you know, the wind and the waves, then he started to sink. If we focus on the wind and the waves, we'll sink. We have an all-powerful Father who does care about us. And remember, in all this, we're talking about our relationship with God, our love for him. So let's learn to give our cares to the Lord, and that will bless the relationship. Okay, the second weed, the second thorn he talks about is riches, or the deceitfulness of riches. Interesting verse from Ecclesiastes. You can interpret two different ways, but I'm going to read that. Ecclesiastes 5. Ecclesiastes 5, verse 12. It says, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. Now, you could interpret that the abundance of the amount of food he had, but if you interpret it the abundance of his wealth, he's worried about this investment and that investment and the business and the everything he has will not suffer him to sleep. It's an interesting thought. I read a story, quite likely some of you read it here too. It's about this lady telling of her childhood when she was back in the South. She would have been descended from the slaves. It wasn't slavery anymore, but apparently they were still living in the slave quarters or something. And it described when they had some kind of party. I'm not sure what they were celebrating, but, you know, all the things they did, not things that could take money, but one of the things they did was they set up this pole in the ground and covered it with Vaseline and put a piece of cake on top, and you have to try to climb the pole to get the cake. And so this was hilarious, watching the boys try to climb this pole until finally someone, I guess all the Vaseline got wiped off, and then someone was able to climb it. Just one example of what they did. The interesting thing was, and these were poor people. The interesting thing was, later on, this girl met the master's daughter. Not, it wasn't the master anymore, because I don't think they were slaves anymore, but this girl who lived in the big house, she made a comment, and I can't get it exactly together how she said it, but that I guess she kind of envied this fun that the poor former slaves were having. You know, she was rich and she did maybe sewing or whatever in the house, and she thought they're the ones that are out there, they're having fun. You don't need to be wealthy to have an enjoyable time. Considering wealth, how many of you know who Darrell Heller is or heard about him? Some of you? Well, the headlines or whatever of the thing that I saw said, Amish and Mennonite investors lose big yet again. $770 million. Now, it was a lot. Was it a couple thousand investors, maybe? I don't know if this fellow was from Mennonite church or if he just had Amish and Mennonites investing in him. Don't know much about it at all. But this is not the first time that conservative people have lost a lot of money. Jesus said, lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. Do some Anabaptist people have too much money? Now, I know there's balancing things to put alongside of that, but I ask the question. You might think, but I may need it someday. Well, Jesus is not opposed to laying up treasure. But he tells you to put it at a safe place, which is in heaven. I'd like to read a verse out of Proverbs. Proverbs 19. Remember, these are all thorns that are taking our eyes off of the Lord and, yeah, destroying our love for him. Okay, Proverbs 19, verse 17. He that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto the Lord, and that which he hath given, he will repay him again. If you take that at face value, you can put your money in heaven, and if it comes to the point you really need it, God will give it back. I'm just taking it for what it says. And in 1 Timothy 6:9 it says, but they that will be rich, in other words, have the goal to get rich, fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. The pursuit of big money is a weed that can destroy your relationship with the Lord. But God says he finds rich faith among the poor. Why does he find rich faith among the poor? Anybody have an idea for why he might find rich faith among the poor? I think if we're honest, if we really consider it, when we have enough money, something bad happens in life, we use our money to fix it. The poor man doesn't have that option. So when something bad happens, he turns to the Lord. The result, his trust in the Lord grows, and he ends up being richer in faith than the rich man. The last pleasure, the last one, the last of these thorns, is pleasures of this life, or the lusts of other things entering in, as it says in Mark. That's a thorn that can crowd out our love for the Lord. Was there ever a time in history when we had more at our fingertips than right now? A trap that parents can fall into, and I'll just give it to you for just to consider it, is you look at your own childhood, the things you didn't like, maybe what was hard in your childhood, and you're going to give your children something better. Now, if you go back another generation, you might be looking back at your childhood and saying, we had to add water to the milk to make it reach because we were that poor. Okay, if you want to give your children a better childhood than that, that's fine. But be careful how far you take this. Who were some of the most wicked people in all of history? Can someone answer that question for me? Take a guess. They weren't the most wicked, but some of the most wicked people. It's okay to be wrong. How's that? Thinking further back in history than that. Further back, yes? Sodom is who I'm thinking of. Not God told his people, the Israelites, that they're more wicked than Sodom at one point. So there's at least one people that were more wicked than Sodom. But I'm thinking of Sodom. God destroyed them with fire and brimstone. A passage in Ezekiel 16. Ezekiel 16, starting at verse 49. It says, behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, abundance of idleness was in her and her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw good. So is it a literal sin? To have enough to eat, idle time, what it says, abundance of idleness. In this thing of a life of ease, let me find where it was. A pampered life of ease will not make a good Christian in us or our children. But I was thinking of, the things you might want to do your children that you didn't have when you were young. Think of the expensive toys or too many toys, too much idle time. Don't have to work. I had to work hard when I was young, so I'm going to make it easy for my children. Beware, you might actually end up ruining your children. Y'all heard the saying, idleness is the devil's workshop. So, he spoke of cares, riches, and the lusts or desires of the flesh? If I ask you all an honest question, will you give yourself an honest answer? Did I miss the weed that you have in your life? Is there something in your life you know is hindering your relationship with the Lord? Maybe it's the app you have on your cell phone. A fellow from church said recently he was spending too much time on this one app. His wife told him he's spending too much time on it, so he got rid of it. Now he's not, it's an app that in and of its, there's good things on it, put it that way. He's not telling everyone else that they can't have it. Did you ever hear of the concept, others may, but I may not? If it's being a snare to your life, get rid of it, even if others have it. There's something that I was going to do, and I went right over it and forgot it. I'm not sure where all, how far back in my notes I was going to do this, but maybe I'll do it now. Do you have markers here? I was going to practice that picture, this picture at home, and forgot to do it, so I hope this doesn't get too bad. But this is a shepherd here. Shepherd staff. And around the shepherd, you have the sheep. Give him some legs. Okay, there you have the shepherd and the sheep. And this is not a fence. This represents the line between, if you ever heard of the concept of you crossed a line where you're in sin. So this represents the line over here, you're in sin. And now we have two sheep right here. Are those sheep in sin? Where's the heart of these sheep? They're with the shepherd. Where's the heart of those sheep? Their heart, and for the sake of clarity, let's just say that you've come back several different times and you consistently find the sheep over there. It's pretty obvious that their heart is not at the right spot. Our love for the Lord, when we have the proper love for the Lord, exactly where that line is becomes less important. Now, granted, life throws us circumstances where we're going to have to, sometimes we're going to have to decide where is the line, but on a consistent basis, if our eyes are always on where is the line, whether it's in, let me just go read those notes. I don't know how I managed to skip over that like that. Maybe I skipped one whole side of a paper or something. I can't even find it. Okay. Whether it's in the music you listen to, we can listen to music that is very clearly acceptable. Or we can choose something that's or the clothes we wear, we can dress in a way that's very clearly acceptable. Nobody in church would think we're out of line. Or, ladies, the way you wear your veil, is your mind on just being obedient, just wearing a veil? Or is it going back? Or men, as you do business out in the world, is it clear you're serving? Who you're serving, or does the world question some of your business deals? Let's keep our eyes on the Lord and not try to get as close to the line as we can. When we love the Lord, that keeps us at the right place. Now, My whole emphasis is love the Lord. Let's serve the Lord because we love Him. I woke up early this morning and I realized there's something that I kind of comes into play here that I didn't say anything about, and that is faith. You're going to have a hard time loving someone you don't trust. And the fact of the matter is, sometimes life throws us things that you might wonder, where is God? Well, I've gone through some deep valleys in life. And I'd like to read you an account of three men that went through a fiery trial. Now, this was a literal fiery trial, but if you apply it to the spiritual, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel 3. Think of this as a fiery trial, whatever your deep, dark valley might be. Daniel 3, you're familiar with the story, but Daniel 3, verse 20. And by the way, are you aware that the king of Babylon is who God used to give a description of Satan? So, the king of Babylon is who threw them in. Satan is behind. He wants to destroy us, destroy our faith. But God allowed it to happen. Okay, starting at verse 20. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, true, O king. He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth, come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, captains, and king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their heads singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Let me ask you a question. Could Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego see the angel? it doesn't see. You could maybe make an argument that the king's counselors couldn't see it either, the way they responded, the maybe not. It doesn't say that they could see the angel. And in the midst of your trial, you might not sense God at all. But what did the fire burn? It burnt the thing that was binding them. And that's what your trial can do you. You've heard it, the saying probably, trials will make you bitter or better. If we keep our eyes on the Lord, hopefully that can make us better. I look back to some of the things I went through in life, and I can see that if God wouldn't have taken through me, obviously I don't know how my life would have turned out, but I can see the possibility if God wouldn't have taken me through that, I could have ended up just a kind of a nominal Mennonite, living a good person, focused on making money. Where would my heart have been at? But because of what God took me through, I'm at a different place today than possibly where I would have been before. Okay, if we yet consider Proverbs 23:26, or just part of the verse there, it says, "My son, give me thine heart." I'm going to apply that to God speaking to us. My son and my daughter, give me your heart. When God has our heart, then things just work out better.